sunset roof. Vines cascaded down the sides. Well-tended bushes and full-sized trees sprouted from the apex of the tower, a little round forest in miniature. In the branches of one of those trees, facing south to the iron sea, was a wooden chair that was regarded as the very highest point in Camor any sane person could reach. The sky garden would be full of children. It was where all the youngest nobles would be released to amuse themselves while their parents tended to the business of the court beneath their feet. The floor they stood on did not cover the full 100-foot width of the tower. It was a hemisphere, covering only the north half of the tower's diameter. Locke grasped a rail at the southern edge of the floor and looked down. There were four other hemispherical galleries beneath them, each about 20 feet below the one above, and each one full of men and women. The vertigo threatened to swallow him again. Staring down at least 80 feet to ground, with the transparent side of the tower and that mind-twisting southern view spread out before him, he felt almost as though the world were tilting on its axis.
"You've got Raven's Reach disease, Lucas," the Don laughed. "You're clutching that rail like a lover. Come have some refreshments. Your eyes will sort out the views in time, and it will all come to seem perfectly normal." "Oh, my lord, Salvara, if only that should prove to be the case, but I would be glad to visit the banquet tables."
The Don led him through the press of silks and cottons and cashmeres and rare furs, nodding here and waving there. Sophia had vanished, along with Reynard. The banquet tables, or perhaps these were merely the appetizer tables, the light afternoon refreshments at a feast like this could rival the main course from any lesser occasion, were laid out with silver-trimmed linen cloths 50 feet from end to end. Guild chefs, the masters of the 8 beautiful arts of Camor, stood at attention in their cream-yellow ceremonial robes and black scholar's caps with hanging gold cords behind their ears. Each chef, male or female, had intricate black tattoos on each of the 4 fingers of their hands, every design representing mastery of one of the 8 gourmet forms. At one end of the banquet table were desserts, the 5th beautiful art. Cherry cream cakes encased in shells of gold leaf that were intended to be eaten. Cinnamon tarts painstakingly assembled with honey-paste glue into the shape of sailing vessels, a whole fleet of little ships with white marzipan sails and raisins for crewmen. There were hollowed-out pears, their cores replaced with cylinders of river melon fruit or brandy creams. There were shaved river melons, their green exteriors scraped down to reveal the pink flesh inside. Every exposed pink face bore a relief sculpture of the crest of Camor, and alchemical globes set within the melons made them glow with an inviting pink light. At the other end of the table were meats. Each one of the silver platters held a phantasmavola, an impossible dish, an imaginary animal formed by joining the halves of 2 separate creatures during preparation and cooking. Locke saw a roast boar with the head of a salmon, resting on a pile of black caviar. Nearby there was a pig's head, complete with a marsh apple in its mouth, with a roast capon for a body. The whole affair was covered in brown caramel sauce and figs, and Locke gave in to the growling sensation at the bottom of his stomach. He let one of the chefs slice him a fair portion of the pig capon, which he ate from a silver dish with a little silver fork. It came apart in his mouth with the texture of butter, and the flavors set his head whirling. He hadn't tasted anything so magnificent in weeks, and he knew that it would have taken all of his powers, with the help of the Sansa brothers at their peak, to prepare something so fine in his old glass cellar. But that thought stole some of the savor from his meal, and he finished quickly. The bullock's head with the body of a squid he was happy to avoid. At the center of the banquet tables was the crowning glory, of this particular level at least. It was a massively unsubtle subtlety, 8 feet in length, an edible sculpture of the city of Camor. The islands were baked sweetbread on little raised metal platforms. The channels between those platforms ran deep with some blue liquor that was being ladled out in cups by a chef at the right side of the diorama. Each major bridge in the city was represented by a crystallized sugar replica. Each major elderglass landmark was given a tiny analog, from the broken tower in the south to the House of Glass Roses to the five towers overlooking everything. Locke peered very closely. There was even a tiny frosted chocolate galleon, little bigger than an almond, floating on a brown pudding wooden waist.
"How are you faring, Lucas?"
Don Salvara was beside him again, wineglass in hand. A black-coated attendant plucked Locke's used dish from his fingers the moment he turned to speak to the Don.
"I am overwhelmed," said Locke, without much exaggeration. "I had no idea what to expect. By the Marrows, perhaps it is well that I had no preconceptions. The court of the King of the Marrows must be like this. I can think of nowhere else that would possibly compare."
"You honor our city with your kind thoughts," said Lorenzo. "I am very pleased you decided to join us. I've just been around chatting with a few of my peers. I'll have a serious talk with one of them in about an hour. I think he'll be good for about 3,000 crowns. I hate to say it, but he's rather malleable, and he's very fond of me."
"Lucas," cried Doña Sofia, as she reappeared with Reynard at her heels, "is Lorenzo showing you around properly?"
"My Lady Salvara, I am quite astounded by the spectacle of this feast. I dare say your husband could leave me sitting in a corner with my thumb in my mouth, and I would be adequately entertained all evening."
"I would do no such thing, of course," laughed Don Salvara. "I was just off speaking to Don Bellarigio, love. He's here with that sculptor he's been patronizing these past few months, that Lasciani fellow with the one eye."
A team of liveried attendants walked past, four men carrying something heavy on a wooden bier between them. The object was a golden glass sculpture of some sort, a gleaming pyramid crested with the arms of Camor. It must have had alchemical lamps within it, for the glass glowed a lovely shade of orange. As Locke watched, the colour shifted to green, and then to blue, and then to white, and back to orange again.
"Oh, how lovely!"
Doña Sofia was clearly enamoured with all things alchemical.
"The shifting hues! Oh, those adjustments must be precise! How I would love to see inside! Tell me, can Don Bellarigio's Lasciani sculpt me one of those?"
Three more teams of men hauled three more sculptures past. Each one shifted through a slightly different pattern of changing colours.
"I don't know," said Reynard. "Those are gifts for the Duke, from one of our more unusual guests. They've been cleared with my superiors. They certainly do look lovely."
Locke turned back to the banquet table and suddenly found himself 6 feet away from Giancana Maraggio, who had an orchid at his breast, a silver plate of fruit in one hand, and a gorgeous young woman in a red gown on the other. Maraggio's gaze passed over Locke, then whirled back, those penetrating eyes fixed on him and on the clothes he wore. The master money-changer opened his mouth, seemed to think better of it, and then opened it again.
"Sir," said Maraggio in a cold voice, "I beg your pardon, but..."
"Why, Master Maraggio?" Don Salvara stepped up beside him. At the sight of a don, Maraggio shut his mouth once again and bowed politely from the waist, though not very deeply.
"Don Salvara," said Maraggio, "and the lovely Doña Sofia, what a pleasure to see you both. Greetings to you as well, Captain Reynard."
He dismissed the tall Vadran from his consideration with a shift of his head and peered at Locke again.
"Master Maraggio," said Locke, "why, what a fortunate coincidence! It is a pleasure to meet you at last. I have looked for you at your counting-house many times, and I am afraid I have never had a chance to pay my proper respects."
"Indeed? Why, I was just about to ask, who might you be, sir?"
"Master Maraggio," said Don Salvara, "allow me to present Lucas Fairwhite, merchant of Emberlane, servant of the House of Bel Oster.
He has come down to discuss the import of a certain quantity of small beer. I'd like to see how those Emberlane ales fare against our native best. Lucas, this is the Honourable Giancarlo Maraggio, master of the counting house that bears his name, known by many as the Duke of White Iron, for very good reason. All finance whirls around him like the constellations in the sky.
Your servant, sir, said Locke.
Of Emberlane? Of the House of Bel Oster?
Why, yes, said Doña Sophia. He's here at the feast as our special guest.
Master Maraggio, said Locke, I hope I do not presume too much, but do you find the cut of my coat pleasing, and the fabric?
A singular question, said Maraggio, scowling, for both seem strangely familiar.
And well they should, said Locke. On the advice of the Salvaras, I secured for myself a single suit of clothes cut in your Camorri style. I requested of the tailor that he select a cut that was especially favored by the best-known taste in the entire city. And who should he name but yourself, sir? This suit of clothes is fashioned after your very own preferences. I hope you will not find me forward if I say that I find it most excellently comfortable.
Oh, no, said Maraggio, looking terribly confused. Oh, no, not too forward at all. Very flattering, sir, very flattering. I do not feel entirely well. The heat, you see. I believe I shall avail myself of some of the punch from that subtlety. It was a pleasure to make your acquaintance, Master Fairwhite. If you will excuse me, Doña Sophia, Don Lorenzo.
Maraggio moved off, peering back over his shoulder at Locke and then shaking his head. Oh, crooked warden, thought Locke. You're one funny son of a bitch, aren't you?
Lucas, said Doña Sophia, have you had enough food for the time being?
I believe I shall keep rather well, my lady.
Good. Why not hunt down Doña Vorcenza with me? She's hiding down on one of the other galleries, hunched over her knitting. If she's lucid today, you'll love her, I guarantee it.
Doña Vorcenza, said Reynard, is in the northernmost apartment of the western gallery, two floors down. Do you know the place I speak of?
Oh, yes, said Sophia. What do you say, Lucas? Let us pay our respects. Lorenzo can circulate and work on the important affairs he should be looking into.
The matter has not slipped my mind, darling, said Don Lorenzo with mock irritation. Master Fairwhite, I, for my part, hope the old Doña is speaking Therin this evening. You may find yourself being introduced to the equivalent of a stone statue, or perhaps she merely behaves that way when I'm in the room.
I wish I could say that it was entirely an affectation, my Lord Salvara, said Reynard. I should circulate for a while and try to look as though I'm actually on duty. Give my affection to Doña Vorcenza, my Lady Sophia.
Of course, Captain. Are you coming, Lucas?
The Doña led him to one of the wide elder-glass staircases with lacquered wooden banisters. Softly glowing alchemical lamps in ornate casings gleamed at the foot of the stairs. They would be lovely after dark. The layout of the floor was the same as that of the one above. There was another 50-foot banquet table crowded with delicacies and wonders, and one of the strangely beautiful glass-and-gold pyramids had been set down beside it. Curious, thought Locke.
"My Lady Salvara," he said, smiling and pointing, "perhaps a few attendants could be convinced to borrow one of those sculptures when we leave, and you could have your peek inside."
"Oh, Lucas, if only! But one does not repay the Duke's hospitality by borrowing his decorative fixtures on a whim. Come, we need to go down to the next level." "Lucas? Lucas, what's the matter?"
Locke had frozen, looking straight at the staircase that led down to the level below. Someone was just coming up that staircase, a lean and fit-looking man in a grey coat, grey gloves, and grey breeches. His vest and four-cornered hat were black, his neckcloths were rich scarlet, and on his left hand he wore a very familiar ring over the leather of his glove. Barsavi's ring, the black pearl of the Cuppar of Camor. Lochlamora matched gazes with Cuppar Raza, his heart beating like a war galley's drum. The Lord of Camor's underworld halted, dumbfounded. Sheer bewilderment fluttered across his face, a look that made mirth rise up from the bottom of Locke's soul. Then for the briefest second there was hatred. Raza ground his teeth together, and the lines of his face tautened. Finally he seemed to have control of himself. He twirled a gold-capped swagger stick of lacquered black witchwood, stuck it beneath his left arm, and strolled casually toward Locke and Doña Sophia. 4.
"Surely," said Cuppar Raza, "surely you must be a Doña of Camor. I do not believe I've had the pleasure of your acquaintance, gracious lady."
He swept off his hat and bent from the waist at the ideal angle, right foot out before his left.
"I am Doña Sofia Salvara of the Isla de Rona," she said. She held out her hand. He took it and kissed the air above it.
"Your servant, my lady Salvara. I am Luciano Anatolius. Charmed, my lady, quite charmed. And your companion? Have we met?"
"I do not believe so, sir," said Locke. "You look strangely familiar, but I'm sure I would recall if we had met before."
"Master Anatolius, this is Lucas Fairwhite, a merchant of Emberlane, of the House of Bel Oster," said Sophia. "My personal guest here at the Duke's feast."
"A merchant of Emberlane. Greetings to you, sir. Why, you must be very resourceful to make it all the way up here into such rarefied circles."
"I do what I must, sir. I do what I must. I have some unusually good friends in Camor. They often bring me unexpected advantages."
"I don't doubt it. The House of Bel Oster, you say? The famous liquor merchants? How grand. I am as fond of a good draught as the next man. In fact, I prefer to make all of my purchases by the cask."
"Indeed, sir," Locke smiled. "Why, that is the specialty of my firm. A great many wonderful and surprising things come out of our casks. We pride ourselves on always giving satisfaction, on always delivering full value for value received. Like for like, if you take my meaning."
"I do," said Cuppar Raza with a grim smile of his own. "An admirable business practice, one near to my own heart."
"But surely," said Locke, "I remember now why you must be familiar, Master Anatolius. Do you not have a sister? Perhaps a pair of them? I seem to recall having met them at some occasion. The resemblance seems very striking."
"No," said Cuppar Raza, scowling. "I'm afraid you're very much mistaken. I have no sisters. Doña Sophia, Master Fairwhite, it has been a distinct pleasure making your acquaintance, but I fear I have pressing business elsewhere. I wish you both much pleasure at the feast this evening."
Locke held out his hand and put on an innocent, friendly smile. "It is always a pleasure to make new acquaintances, Master Anatolius. Perhaps we shall see each other again?"
Cuppar Raza glared down at Locke's outstretched hand, then seemed to remember himself. He could hardly refuse such a courtesy without causing a great stir. His strong hand clasped Locke's forearm, and Locke returned the gesture. The fingers of Locke's other hand twitched. If only his stiletto had not been inconveniently hidden in a boot, he would now be tempted beyond all rational thought.
"You are very good, Master Fairwhite," said Cuppar Raza with a placid face, "but I very much doubt it."
"If I have learned anything about this city, Master Anatolius," said Locke, "I have learned that it is quite full of surprises. A very good evening to you."
"And to you," said Raza, "merchant of Emberlane."
He moved quickly away into the crowd. Locke watched him all the way. Raza turned once, and their eyes locked yet again, and then the cuppa was gone, up the stairs to the next level, grey coat fluttering in his wake.
"Lucas," said Doña Sophia, Did I miss something?
Miss something? Locke gave her another innocent, fair white smile. I don't believe so, my lady. It is just that that man greatly resembled someone I once knew.
A friend from Emberlane?
Oh, no, said Locke. Not a friend. And the man in question is dead. He is very, very dead. Aware that he was clenching his teeth, he let ease return to his countenance. Shall we go find your Doña Vorcenza, my lady?
Why, yes, said Sophia. Yes, let's be about it. Do follow me.
She led him down the stairs Raza had come up, down to yet another gallery packed rim to rim with the quality. Blue bloods and gold bloods, as Father Chains might have put it. Instead of a banquet table, this level held a bar, 40 feet of polished witchwood staffed by 24 men and women in the Duke's livery. Behind them, on tables and shelves, rose thousands upon thousands of glass bottles. Alchemical lamps had been placed behind them, and they bathed the gallery in cascading ribbons of colour. Huge pyramids of wine glasses and beer glasses were set off to the sides of the bar, cordoned off behind velvet ropes. One unprofessional gesture would send hundreds of crowns' worth of fine crystal crashing to the floor. Black jackets stood at stiff attention beside the glass pyramids as an added assurance. And speaking of pyramids, another one of the lovely pyramid sculptures had been set out here, a few feet to the right of the bar, behind one of the velvet ropes. Doña Sofia led him to the west, past the bar and the long line of nobles waiting to take in the liquid courage of their choice. Some of them were already obviously impaired in the fine art of standing up straight. On the western wall of the gallery there was a heavy witchwood door bearing the silver seal of Duke Nicovante's personal arms. Doña Sofia pushed this door open and led him into a curving hallway lit by the soft silver glow of alchemical lanterns. There were three doors in this hall, and Doña Sofia brought him to the one at the far end, near what Locke supposed was the northern wall of the tower.
Now, said Doña Sofia with a smirk, it will either be Doña Vorcenza, or it will be a pair of young people doing something they should not.
She slid the door open and peeked inside, and then tugged on Locke's sleeve.
"It's quite all right," she whispered. "It's her."
Locke and Sophia were looking into a nearly square chamber with a slightly curved outer wall. Unlike the public galleries, the elderglass surface in this part of the tower was opaque. A single window was on the northern wall, its wooden shade cracked open to let in the sunlight and the warm air of the late afternoon. There was a single tall-backed wooden chair in the room, and it held a single hunchbacked old lady. She was bent over a pair of glittering needles, utterly fixated on the unidentifiable object that was flowing into her lap from her efforts. A few rolls of black wool yarn lay at her feet. She was eccentrically dressed, in a man's black coat and a pair of dark purple pantaloons such as cavalry officers traditionally wore. Her little black slippers curved up at the ends like something from a fairy story. Her eyes seemed to be clear behind her half-moon optics, but they didn't look up from her knitting when Doña Sofia led Locke into the center of the room.
Doña Vorcenza?
Sofia cleared her throat and raised her voice.
Doña Vorcenza? It's Sofia, my lady. I've brought someone for you to meet.
Snick, snick, went Doña Vorcenza's needles. Snick, snick, but those eyes did not look up.
Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, said Sofia to Locke, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, she comes and goes.
Sofia sighed.
Might I beg you to stay here with her for just a moment? I'm going to the bar. She often takes white wine. Perhaps a glass of it will bring her back to us.
Of course, Doña Sofia, said Locke cheerfully. I would be very honoured to wait on the Countess. Fetch her whatever you feel proper.
Can I bring you anything, Lucas?
Oh, no, you are too kind, my lady. I shall have something later, perhaps.
Sophia nodded and withdrew from the room, closing the door with a click behind her. Locke paced for a few moments, hands behind his back. Snick, snick, went the needles. Snick, snick. Locke raised an eyebrow. The object flowing forth from those needles remained a perfect mystery. Perhaps it wasn't yet near completion. He sighed, paced a bit more, and turned to stare out the window. The green and brown hills spread out to the curving horizon north of the city. Locke could see the brown lines of roads and the parti-coloured roofs of small buildings and the grey-blue of the Angevine, all fading into heat haze and distance. The sun suffused everything in hot white light. There wasn't a cloud to be seen. There was a sudden vicious stabbing pain at the back of his neck, on the left side. Locke whirled and slapped a hand to the site of the pain. There was a bit of wetness beneath his fingers. Doña Angiovesta Vorcenza, Dowager Countess of Amberglass, stood before him, drawing back the knitting needle she had just plunged into the back of his neck. Now her eyes were lively behind those half-moon optics, and a smile broke out of the network of lines on her lean face.
"Gah!"
He rubbed at the back of his neck and maintained his Vajran accent only with the greatest difficulty. "What the hell was that?"
"Grief, Willow, Master Thorn," said Doña Vorcenza. "The poison of the grief willow tree, which I'm sure you've heard of. You have but a few minutes to live, and now I should very much like to spend them speaking to you."
5.
You...
"Stabbed you in the neck. Yes, well, I must confess it gave me pleasure, dear boy. What can I say? You have led us on a trying chase."
But, Doña Vorcenza, I do not understand. How have I given offense?"
"You may abandon the Vajran accent. It's excellent, but I'm afraid you won't be able to smile and bluff your way out of this one, Master Thorn."
Locke sighed and rubbed his eyes. "Doña Vorcenza, if that needle was really poisoned, why the hell should I bother telling you anything?"
"Now that's a sensible question."
She reached down the front of her tunic and drew out a little glass vial, capped with silver.
"In exchange for your cooperation, I'm prepared to offer you the antidote. You will, of course, come peacefully with me. You're hundreds of feet in the air, and every one of my midnighters is currently here, dressed as staff. You'd be rather ignominiously treated if you tried to run so much as 10 feet past that hallway."
"Your midnighters? You mean... You must be fucking kidding! You're the spider?"
"Yes," she said. "And by the gods, it feels good to finally fling that in the face of someone who can appreciate it."
"But," said Locke, "the spider is, or at least I thought the spider was..."
"A man? You and all the rest of this city, Master Thorn. I have always found the presumptions of others to be the best possible disguise. Haven't you?"
Locke chuckled morosely. A tingling numbness was spreading around the wound. It definitely wasn't just his imagination. "Hanged by my own rope, Doña Vorcenza."
"You must be brilliant, Master Thorn," said Doña Vorcenza. "I shall give you that. To know what you've done, to keep my people guessing these past few years. Gods, I wish I didn't have to put you in a crow's cage. Perhaps a deal could be arranged, once you've had a few years to think it over. It must be very new and very odd to finally have someone spring such a trap on you."
"Oh, no." Locke sighed and put his face in his hands. "Oh, Doña Vorcenza, I'm so sorry to disappoint you, but the list of people that haven't outsmarted me seems to be getting smaller all the fucking time."
"Well," said Doña Vorcenza, "that can't be pleasant. But come, you must be feeling rather strange by now. You must be unsteady on your feet. Just say yes. Give me the location of the funds you've stolen, and perhaps those years in the Palace of Patience can be mitigated. Give me the names of your accomplices, and I'm sure an accommodation can be reached."
"Doña Vorcenza,"
said Locke forcefully. "I have no accomplices, and even if I did, I certainly wouldn't tell you who they were."
"What about Grauman?"
"Grauman is a hireling," said Locke. "He thinks I'm really a merchant of Emberlane."
"And those so-called bandits in the alley beside the Temple of Fortunate Waters?"
"Hirelings, long since fled back to Talisham."
"And the false Midnighters, the ones who visited the Salvaras?"
"Homunculi," said Locke. "They crawl out of my ass every full moon. They've been a problem for years."
"Oh, Master Thorn, Grief Willow will still that tongue of yours rather permanently. You don't have to speak your secrets now. Just surrender so I can give you this vial, and we can continue this conversation in more pleasant surroundings."
Locke stared at Doña Vorcenza for several long seconds. He locked his gaze with those ancient eyes of hers and saw the obvious satisfaction in them, and his right hand curled into a fist of its own accord. Perhaps Doña Vorcenza was so used to her aura of privilege she forgot their disparity in ages. Perhaps she'd simply never conceived that a man of apparent refinement, even a criminal, could do what Locke did next. He punched her square in the teeth, a whirling right that would have been comical had he thrown it against a younger, sturdier woman. But it snapped Doña Vorcenza's head back. Her eyes rolled up, and she buckled at the knees. Locke caught her as she toppled, carefully plucking the vial from her fingers while he did so. He heaved her back into her chair, then uncapped the vial and poured its contents down his throat. The warm fluid tasted like citrus. He gulped it eagerly and threw the vial aside. Then, working with the utmost haste, he took off his coat and used it to tie Doña Vorcenza into her chair, knotting the sleeves several times behind her back. Her head lolled forward and she groaned. Locke gave her a pat on the shoulder. On an impulse, he ran his hands quickly and as politely as possible through her waistcoat. He grunted in satisfaction when he turned up a little silk purse jingling with coins. "Not what I was hoping for," he said, "but we'll call it fair payment for a god's damned needle in the neck, hm?" Locke stood up and paced for a few moments. He turned back to Doña Vorcenza, knelt before her, and said, "My lady, it wounds me to have to treat someone such as yourself so crudely. The truth is, I admire you very much, and at any other time I'd be very curious to hear just where I fucked up and tipped you off. But you must admit, I'd have to be crazy to go with you. The Palace of Patience simply does not suit. So thank you for the very interesting afternoon, and give my regards to Don and Doña Salvara." With that, he pushed the wooden shutter as wide as it would go and stepped out the window. The exterior of Raven's Reach, considered up close, was actually covered with irregularities, with little indentations and ledges, circling the tower at virtually every level. Locke slipped out onto a slender ledge about 6 inches wide. He pressed his stomach up against the warm glass of the tower and waited for the pounding of the blood within his temples to cease sounding like a pummeling from a heavy man's fists. It didn't, and he sighed. "I am the king, idiot," he muttered, "of all the world's fucking idiots." The warm wind pushed at his back as he inched to his right. The ledge grew wider a few moments later, and he found an indentation in which to place his hand. Confident that he was in no immediate danger of falling, Locke glanced downward over his shoulder and immediately regretted it. Seeing Camor spread out behind glass offered a layer of insulation between the viewer and the vista. Out here, it seemed as though the whole world fell away in a vast arc. He wasn't 600 feet in the air. He was 1,000, 10,000, 1,000,000, some incomprehensible number of feet that only the gods were fit to dare. He squeezed his eyes shut and clutched at the glass wall as though he could pour himself into it like mortar into stones. The pork and capon in his stomach made enthusiastic inquiries about coming up in a nauseous torrent. His throat seemed to be on the verge of granting the request. "Gods," he thought, "I wonder if I'm on one of the transparent sections of the tower. I must look pretty fucking funny." There was a creaking noise from overhead. He looked up and gasped. One of the elevator cages was coming down toward him. It would be in line with him on the face of the tower, and it would pass by about 3 feet from the wall he was clinging to. It was empty.
"Crooked Warden," Locke whispered. "I'll do this, but the only thing I ask, the only thing, is that when this is done, you make me fucking forget. Steal this memory out of my head, and I will never climb more than 3 feet off the ground as long as I draw breath. Praise be."
The cage creaked down. It was 10 feet above him, then 5 feet, and then its bottom was even with his eyes. Breathing in deep, ragged, panicky gasps, Locke turned himself around on the tower so that his back was against the glass. The sky and the world beneath his feet both seemed too big to fit into his eyes. Gods, he didn't want to think about them. The cage was sliding past. Its bars were right there, 3 feet away, over 50-some stories of empty air. He screamed and pushed himself off the glass wall of the tower. When he hit the blackened iron sidebars of the cage, he clung as desperately as any cat ever clung to a tree branch. The cage swayed back and forth, and Locke did his best to ignore the incredible things that did to the sky and the horizon. The cage door. He had to slip the cage door. They closed tight, but didn't have elaborate locks. Working with hands that shivered as though the air were freezing, Locke slipped the bolt on the cage's door and let it fall open. He then swung himself gingerly around the corner, from the exterior to the interior, and with one last burst of dreadful vertigo reached out and slammed the door shut behind him. He sat down on the floor of the cage, gasping in deep breaths, shaking with relief and the after-effects of the poison.
"Well," he muttered, "that was fucking hideous."
Another elevator cage full of noble guests drew upward, 20 feet to his right. The men and women in the cage looked at him very curiously, and he waved. He half dreaded that the cage would lurch to a halt before it reached the ground and start to draw back up. He decided, if it did, that he would take his chances with the Palace of Patience. But the cage continued all the way down. Vorcenza must still be tied to her chair, out of the action. Locke was on his feet when the cage settled against the ground. The liveried men who opened the door peered in at him with wide eyes.
"Excuse me," said one of them, "but were you in this cage when it left the embarkation platform?"
"Of course," said Locke. "That shape you saw darting out from the tower? Bird. Biggest goddamned bird you ever saw. Scared the piss right out of me, let me tell you. I say, are any of these carriages for hire?"
"Go to the outer row," said the footman, "and look for the ones with the white flags and lanterns."
"Much obliged."
Locke rapidly perused the contents of Doña Vorcenza's coin purse. There was a very satisfactory quantity of gold and silver inside. He tossed a solon apiece to the liveried men beside the cage as he stepped out.
"It was a bird, right?"
"Yes, sir," said the other man with a tip of his black cap. "Biggest God's damned bird we ever saw."
6. The hired carriage left him at the Hill of Whispers. He paid very well, the forget-you-made-this-run sort of well, and then he walked south through Ashfall on his own. It was perhaps the 6th hour of the evening when he returned to the hovel, bursting through the curtained door, yelling as he came,
"Jean, we have one hell of a fucking problem!"
The falconer stood in the center of the little room, smirking at Locke, his hand folded before him. Locke took in the tableau in a split second. Ibelius lay motionless against the far wall, and Jean lay slumped at the bondsmage's feet, writhing in pain. Vestris perched upon her master's shoulder. She fixed him with those black and gold eyes, then opened her beak and screeched triumphantly. Locke winced at the noise.
"Oh, yes, Master Lamora," said the falconer. "Yes, I'd say you do have one hell of a fucking problem."
Interlude. The Throne in Ashes. Therim Pell was once called the Jewel of the Eldrin. It was the largest and grandest of the cities that the lost race of ancients left to the men who claimed their lands long after their disappearance. Therim Pell sat at the headwaters of the Angevine River, where they poured in a white torrent from the mountains. It sat beneath their craggy majesty and was surrounded by rich fields for 2 days' ride by fast horse in any other direction. In the autumn those fields would be swaying with stalks of amber, a bounty fit for the seat of an empire, which Therin Pell was. All the cities of the south knelt before the Therin throne. The engineers of the empire built tens of thousands of miles of roads to weave those cities together. The empire's generals manned them with patrols to put bandits down, and maintained garrisons at smaller towns and villages to ensure that commerce and letters could flow, without interruption, from one end of the empire to the other, from the Iron Sea to the Sea of Brass. Carthane and Lashane, Nessek and Talisham, Espara and Ashmere, Iridane and Camor, Balinel and Isara. All those mighty city-states were ruled by dukes who took their crowns of silver from the hands of the emperor himself. The few dukes who remain in present times may wield great power, but they are self-declared. The high lineages dating back to the time of the Therin throne have long been severed. The Therin throne entered into decline when the Vardrans appeared from the north. A raiding sea people, they took the throne protectorates on the northern half of the continent. They named the seven great rivers that flowed to the northern sea their seven holy marrows, and they discouraged the throne's efforts to reclaim its territory by smashing every army it sent north. Weakened, the Therin throne could not sustain the effort, and so it was diminished. Diminished, but not broken. It took the Bonds Magi of Carthane to do that. The Bonds Magi were newly formed in the city of Carthane. They were beginning to expand the reach of their unique and deadly guild to other cities, and they showed little sign of catering to the angry demands of the emperor in Therin Pell. He insisted that they halt their activities, and they are said to have replied with a short letter listing the prices for which his august majesty could hire their services. The emperor sent in his own royal circle of sorcerers. They were slain without exception. The emperor then raised his legions and marched on Carthane, vowing to slay every sorcerer who claimed the title of bondsmage. The emperor's declaration of war was a test of resolve for the new guild's rules. For anyone who dared to harm a bondsmage, they had publicly vowed reciprocity that would be awful to behold. During his march to Carthane, the emperor's soldiers managed to kill about a dozen. 400 Bonds Magi met the emperor's legions just to the east of Carthane. The sorcerers condescended to offer a pitched battle. In less than 2 hours, 1/3 of the emperor's forces were slaughtered. Strange mists boiled up from the ground to mislead their maneuvers. Illusions and phantasms tormented them. Flights of arrows halted in the air and fell to the ground, or were hurled back upon the archers who had loosed them. Comrade turned upon comrade, maddened and misled by sorcery that could chain a man's actions as though he were a marionette. The emperor himself was hacked to pieces by his personal guard. It is said that no piece larger than a finger remained to be burned on a pyre afterward. The empire was soundly defeated, its surviving generals routed, their remaining soldiers scampering like message runners for Therin Pell. But the affair did not end there. The Bonds Magi in conclave decided to enforce their rules, and to enforce them in such a fashion that the entire world would shudder at the thought of crossing them, for as long as men might have memories. They worked their retribution on the city of Therin Pell. The firestorm they conjured was unnatural. 400 Magi, working in concert, kindled something at the heart of the empire that historians still fear to describe. It is said that the flames were as white as the hearts of the stars themselves, that the column of black smoke rose so high it could be seen from the deep Iron Sea, far east of Camor, and as far north as Vintilla, capital of the young kingdom of the Seven Marrows. Even this hideous conjuring could not touch Elderglass. Those structures in the city built by Eldrin Art survived unscathed. But everything else the fire touched, it ate. Wood and stone and metal, mortar and paper and living things. all the city's buildings and all the city's culture and all the city's population who could not flee before the Magi began their work were burnt into a desert of grey ashes, a desert that settled a foot deep across a black scar baked into the ground. Those ashes swirled in the hot wind at the foot of the one human-crafted object the Magi willingly preserved, the throne of the Empire. That chair remains there to this day, in the haunted city of Therimpel, surrounded by a field of ashes that time and rains have turned into a sort of black concrete. Nothing grows in Therimpel anymore. No sensible man or woman will set foot within that black monument to the resolve of the Bonds Magi of Carthane. It was they who broke the Therin throne with that unearthly fire. They who cast the city-states of the south into hundreds of years of warring and feuding, while the kingdom of the Seven Marrows grew powerful in the north. It is that image that comes to mind when most men think to cross a Bonds Mage. The image of an empty chair standing alone in a dry sea of desolation. Chapter 16. Justice is Red. 1. The falconer moved his fingers, and Locke Lamora fell to his knees, gripped by an all-too-familiar pain that burned within his bones. He toppled onto the floor of the hovel beside Jean.
"What a pleasure!" said the sorcerer, "to see that you survived our little arrangement at the Echo Hole. I'm impressed, even despite your reputation. I had imagined we were too clever for you. Only this afternoon I thought it was Jean Tannen alone that I sought, but this is something finer by far."
"You!" spat Locke, "are a twisted fucking animal!"
"No," said the Bonds Mage. I obey the orders of my paying client, and my orders are to make sure the murderer of my client's sisters takes his time in dying." The falconer cracked his knuckles. "You I regard as a windfall."
Locke screamed and reached out toward the bondsmage, willing himself forward through the pain, but the falconer muttered under his breath, and the racking, stabbing sensations seemed to multiply tenfold. Locke flopped onto his back and tried to breathe, but the muscles behind and beneath his lungs were as solid as stones. When the bondsmaid released him from this torment, he slumped down, gasping. The room spun.
"It's very strange," said the falconer, "how the evidence of our victories can become the instruments of our downfall. Jean Tannen, for example. You must be a fantastic fighter to have taken my client's sisters, though I see you suffered in doing so. And now they've struck back at you from the Shade Lands. A great many divinations are possible when one of my kind can get his hands on the physical residue of another man. Fingernail parings, for example, locks of hair, blood on the edge of a knife."
Jean groaned, unable to speak from pain.
"Oh, yes," said the falconer. "I was certainly surprised to see who that blood led me to. In your shoes, I'd have been in the first caravan to the other side of the continent. You might even have been left in peace."
"Gentlemen bastards," hissed Locke, "do not abandon one another, and we do not run when we owe vengeance."
"That's right," said the bondsmage. "And that's why they also die at my feet in filthy fucking hovels like this one."
Vestris fluttered from his shoulder and settled into another corner of the room, staring balefully down at Locke, twitching her head from side to side in excitement. The falconer reached inside his coat and drew out a sheet of parchment, a quill, and a small bottle of ink. He uncapped the bottle and set it down atop the sleeping pallet. He wet the quill and smiled down at Locke.
"Jean Tannen," said the falconer. "What a simple name. Easy to write, easier even than it was to stitch."
His quill flew across the parchment. He wrote in great looping whorls, and his smile grew with every letter. When he was finished, his silver thread snaked out around the fingers of his left hand, and he moved them with an almost hypnotic rhythm. A pale silver glow arose from the page in his hands, outlining the curves of his face.
"Jean Tannen," said the falconer. "Arise, Jean Tannen. I have a task for you."
Shuddering, Jean rose first to his knees and then to his feet. He stood before the falconer. Locke, for his part, still found it impossible to move.
"Jean Tannen," said the bondsmage, "take up your hatchets. Nothing would please you more at this moment than to take up your hatchets."
Jean reached beneath the sleeping pallet and took out the wicked sisters. He slipped one into either hand, and the corners of his mouth drew upward.
"You like to use those, don't you, Jean?"
The falconer shifted the silver threads in his left hand.
"You like to feel them biting into flesh. You like to see the blood spatter. Oh, yes. Don't worry. I have a task you can set them to."
With the sheet of paper in his right hand, the falconer gestured down at Locke.
"Kill Locke Lamora," he said.
Jean shuddered. He took a step toward Locke, then hesitated. He frowned and closed his eyes.
"I name your given name, Jean Tannen," said the bondsmage. "I name your given name, the truthful name, the name of the spirit. I name your name. Kill Locke Lamora. Take up your hatchets and kill Locke Lamora."
Jean took another halting step toward Locke. His hatchets rose slowly. He seemed to be clenching his jaws. A tear rolled out of his right eye. He took a deep breath and then another step. He sobbed and raised the wicked sisters above his shoulders.
"No," said the falconer. "Oh, no. Wait. Step back."
Jean obliged, backing off a full yard from Locke, who sent up silent prayers of relief, mingled with dread for whatever might come next.
"Jean's rather soft-hearted," said the falconer. "But you're the real weakling, aren't you? You're the one who begged me to do anything to you as long as I left your friends alone. You're the one who went into the barrel with his lips closed when he could have betrayed his friends and perhaps lived. I know how to make this right. Jean Tannen, drop your hatchets."
The wicked sisters hit the ground with a heavy thud, bounced, and landed just beside Locke's eyes. A moment later, the bondsmage spoke in his sorcerous tongue and shifted the threads in his left hand. Jean screamed and fell to the ground, shaking feebly.
"It would be much better, I think," said the falconer, "if you were to kill Jean, Master Lamora."
Vestris screeched down at Locke. The sound had the strange, mocking undertones of laughter. "Oh, fuck," Locke thought. "Oh, gods!"
"Of course," said the falconer. "We already know your last name is a sham. But I don't need a full name. Even a fragment of a true name will be quite enough. You'll see, Locke. I promise that you'll see."
His silver threads disappeared. He dipped his quill once again and wrote briefly on the parchment.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, you may move again."
And as he spoke, it was so. The paralysis lifted, and Locke twitched his fingers experimentally. The bondsmage wiggled his silver thread once more. Locke felt a strange something seem to form in the air around him, a sort of pressure, and the parchment glowed again.
"Now," said the falconer, "I name your name, Locke. I name your given name, the truthful name, the name of the spirit. I name your name, Locke. Arise. Arise and take up Jean Tannen's hatchets. Arise and kill Jean Tannen."
Locke pushed himself up to his knees and rested on his hands for a moment.
"Kill Jean Tannen."
Shaking, he reached out for one of Jean's hatchets, slid it toward himself, and crawled forward with it clutched in his right hand. His breathing was ragged. Jean Tannen lay at the bondsmage's heels, just 3 or 4 feet away, on his face in the plaster dust of the hovel.
"Kill Jean Tannen."
Locke paused at the falconer's feet and turned his head slowly to stare at Jean. One of the big man's eyes was open, unblinking. There was real terror there. Jean's lips quivered uselessly, trying to form words. Locke pushed himself up and raised the hatchet. He bellowed wordlessly. He jabbed up with the heavy ball of the hatchet. The blow struck home right between the falconer's legs. The silver thread and the parchment fluttered from the bondsmage's hands as he gasped and fell forward, clutching at his groin. Locke whirled to his right, expecting instant attack from the scorpion hawk. But to his surprise, the bird had fallen from its perch and was writhing on the hovel floor, wings beating uselessly at the air, a series of choked half-screeches issuing from its beak. Locke smiled the cruelest smile he'd ever worn in his entire life as he rose to his feet.
"It's like that, is it?"
He grinned fiercely at the bondsmage as he slowly raised the hatchet, ball side down.
"You see what she sees. Each of you feels what the other feels."
The words brought him a warm sense of exultation, but they nearly cost him the fight. The falconer managed to find concentration enough to utter one syllable and curl his fingers into claws. Locke gasped and staggered back, nearly dropping the hatchet. It felt as though a hot dagger had been shoved through both of his kidneys. The sizzling pain made it impossible to act or even to think. The falconer attempted to stand up, but Jean Tannen suddenly rolled toward him and reached up, grabbing him by the lapels. The big man yanked hard, and the falconer crashed back down, forehead first, against the floor of the hovel. The pain in Locke's guts vanished, and Vestris screeched once again from the floor beside his feet. He wasted no further time. He whipped the hatchet down in a hammer blow, breaking Vestris' left wing with a dry crack. The falconer screamed and writhed, flailing hard enough to briefly break free from Jean's grasp. He clutched at his left arm and hollered, his eyes wide with shock. Locke kicked him in the face, hard, and the bondsmage rolled over in the dust, spitting up the blood that was suddenly running from his nose.
"Just one question, you arrogant fucking cocksucker," said Locke. "I'll grant the Lamora part is easy to spot. The truth is, I didn't know about the apt translation when I took the name. I borrowed it from this old sausage dealer who was kind to me once, back in Catchfire before the plague. I just liked the way it sounded."
"But what the fuck," he said slowly, "ever gave you the idea that Locke was the first name I was actually born with?" He raised the hatchet again, reversed it so the blade side was toward the ground, and then brought it down with all of his strength, severing Vestris' head completely from her body. The sound of the bird's suddenly interrupted screech echoed and merged with the screams of the falconer, who clutched at his head and kicked his legs wildly. His cries were pure madness, and it was a mercy to the ears of Locke and Jean when they died, and he fell sobbing into unconsciousness. 2. The falconer of Carthane awoke to find himself lying spread-eagled, arms and legs out on the dusty floor of the hovel. The smell of blood was in the air, Vestris blood. He closed his eyes and began to weep.
"He is secure, Master Lamora," said Ibelius.
When the dog-leech had awoken from whatever spell the bondsmage had flung at him, he'd been only too eager to help tie the Carthani down. He and Jean had scavenged some metal stakes from the other side of the structure. These were pounded into the floor, and the bondsmage was lashed to them by long strips of bedding, tied tight around his wrists and ankles. Smaller strips had been tied around his fingers, and had been used to pad between them, immobilizing them.
"Good," said Locke.
Jean Tannen sat on the sleeping pallet, looking down at the bondsmage with dull, deeply shadowed eyes. Locke stood at the sorcerer's feet, staring down at him with undisguised loathing. A small oil fire burned in a glass jar. Ibelius crouched beside it, slowly heating a dagger over it. The thin brown smoke curled up toward the ceiling.
"You are fools," said the falconer between sobs, "if you think to kill me. My brethren will take satisfaction. Think on the consequences."
"I'm not going to kill you," said Locke. "I'm going to..."